agencies, which I did for many years, and you speak to aid groups like the International Rescue Committee, who specializes in this kind of management, one of the things they say is keep the families together. You always have to keep the families together. And if you separate them, make sure the kids have name tags, even if it means scrawling their names on their skin, which is actually what they've done in Pakistan since the earthquake.
Well, Tina Sussman, this is part one of this discussion. I ask you if you can come back next week because, and Leah Hodges, this is too important to leave here. We will continue our series and the aftermath of Katrina more than 3 months after the hurricane. Tina Sussman of Newsday, Leah Hodges, a New Orleans community leader and evacuee now in Atlanta. That does it for the broadcast. Our website, democracynow.org. Our producers, Mike Berkshire, Abdel Kaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Again, our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Radio Free Nashville relies on listener donations and underwriters. To find out how you can help, visit our website at www.radiofreenashville.org. Thanks for listening to Radio Free Nashville, your community radio station.
No to ludzie, słyszycie? WRFN Pasqua, Dziewięć Dziesiąt Osiem Dziewięć.
Shibish, bibish, bibish, bebish.
Scooter?
Yes, ma'am.
Gonzo?
Check.
Robin?
Yes, Miss Biggie.
This is what we're going to sing. Christmas is coming, the goose is getting fat.
Nice.
Please do put the penny in the old man's hat. If you haven't got the penny, a halfpenny will do. If you haven't got the halfpenny, then God bless you.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Now, Scooter,
uh-huh.
You come in after my first line,
right.
And you two boys follow.
And good afternoon, morning, day, night, whenever you're listening to us. This is Christian Dissent Live, broadcasting from deep within the hills of rural Tennessee. I'm Cole Wakefield. With me this morning, for the first time in like, it seems like a month, we are all three in the studio together. My colleagues at Christian Dissent, Josh Tinley. Good morning, Josh.
Hello.
And Joey Hood, who I can't see.
Hello.
There we go.
Can you hear me?
No, I can hear you.
My microphone's very droopy this morning. It looks like it needs Viagra.
Droopy microphone, yeah. I'm sorry. Our Enzyte. That song we played, the Muppet, it's a Muppet Christmas song. I think it's what they play in the at Gitmo to the Al-Qaeda prisoners over and over and over again to get them to actually talk.
You think so?
I think so. It's a great song, but I can imagine that song over
yeah.
and over again.
I thought
again.
They played Britney Spears.
Well, that's who she... Did you hear that she broke up with her husband?
No.
I just saw it. I was at Target yesterday, and it was on the cover of, like, three magazines.
Yeah, I saw it on tabloids.
She canceled his credit card, towed his car.
I don't believe it till I hear it from E.T.
Well, it's been a long time. I'm glad everybody's back in the studio.
I'm the prodigal son. I've returned.
Yes, Joey has returned. He doesn't have work or a date or whatever stuff he uses as an excuse not to show up on the show.
Today I was going to use the excuse that it's too cold and it might snow.
Is it supposed to snow this morning?
Yeah.
Oh.
All right.
Well, how about this? I on my way here this morning, I was driving down the road and in Nashville, or actually this is, I guess... Are we still in Nashville if we're in Pasqua?
We're in Metro Davidson County.
Okay.
So it's, we have Unigov, so it's complicated.
Okay, so
we're
you're sort of
kind of in, kind of not.
Whoa. Okay,
I'm gonna, that droopy microphone.
Okay, you ready? I'm going to turn you back up now.
Okay.
Okay. Wow.
It fell completely off of its handle, the microphone.
We are professionals here.
Yeah, and we joke about that, but in the last couple of weeks, they've upgraded the board.
Yeah, actually, things are...
They've soundproofed the room.
Yeah, they've got some foam.
They put some...
A little bit here and there. Acoustic panel.
They've mounted a guitar.
Yeah, that used to just sit on the...
Propped up against the wall.
Yeah, we're really making steps. And this new board, actually, the sound quality is much better going out over the air. So
I feel like
Oprah. And we got a new transmitter. You feel like Oprah with your big furry mic?
Yeah, holding it.
Well, I was going to say, on my way here this morning, in this Nashville area, there's this equestrian track where they have this like yearly horse race where all the rich people go and wear big hats. And they can't gamble, but you just watch the horse race, right?
You can drink. That's the big thing.
I don't understand, but it's this huge thing. Well, anyway, on my way here, it's on my way to the station, and I was driving down this road, and you can see a good distance, and I see this, like, bright light, and as I get closer, it's a fire, and then I'm trying to figure out what's on fire, like, is somebody burning brush, even though it's not time to do that.
Yeah, 5:30 in the morning.
Or what? No, it was somebody's truck's on fire. Like, this entire pickup truck was engulfed in flames. But luckily, nobody was hurt. I did stop and check, and there were other people stopped, and the fire department was on its way. But if I wasn't going to be here, I mean, I was afraid that I was going to have to stop and help. I mean, not that I'm afraid to help, but that I would have missed the show, and then you guys would have been stuck without me.
What would we have done?
Yeah, we don't know how to use the equipment.
Yeah, this new board's really complicated. You know, you actually have to use 3 sliders for all the mics instead of just the...
Yeah, that's going to be complicated.
Instead of the 1 slider and the 3 knobs that we used to have.
Well, I guess we do get rid of those knobs.
Yeah, so that makes sense.
I was wondering
easier.
What was missing on the rack there, right. But that makes sense. That was a superfluous piece.
So
the Nashville Fire Department, by the way, they are good people.
They are, yes, because you got to know them, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. We had a carbon monoxide scare the other day. Our carbon monoxide alarm started going off, and you know, occasionally it'll go off and it'll just say check battery. There's a separate light for that.
Mm-hmm.
But this time it was the light that said, you know, evacuate now, move to fresh air. So we did that, and we have 4 cats that, you know, I wasn't willing to.
To let suffocate.
To suffocate, right. Yeah. So we had to get all of them in the car. And so there was, you know, 4 cats and a toddler and in 1 vehicle. Yeah. And but eventually the fire, what I was saying about the fire department, our neighbor checked it because he has like a little home scanner sniffer thing for carbon monoxide. And he couldn't pick anything up. So he said do 862-8600, which is the... kind of the baby 911.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's that way in all cities, certain areas, but I know other cities have that.
Right. It's a non-emergency number.
Right. So we said, you know, we got a place to stay. We're out. This is not an emergency, but our carbon monoxide alarm went off. And just when you have a chance, could you come out and just double check to make sure it's safe? And they were there in 10 minutes with their lights flashing.
Wow.
And they weren't mad at us for,
well, that's good.
They just happened to be in the area, but they were very friendly.
The fire department just happened to be in the area, yeah, because, you know, they got a station down the block, like, because they're the fire department, right?
Well, I think they were called for something else in the area.
Oh, okay.
So,
But, I mean, it's like the point for the fire department to be in the area, right, normally.
Yeah, yeah. They have...
Sorry, I'm just...
They have branches and so forth.
It's like saying the library's in the area, you know.
Well, right, okay, so... They were close to my neighborhood. They were already mobile, and they came by and they actually because you know some people you when you try to be err on the side of safety, which you start doing when you have a toddler. Because before that, I would just put my life at risk probably. But
well, that's probably why you even have a carbon monoxide alarm. I don't.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so. You know, when you err on the side of caution, so there are some people who just get really annoyed with you. But the fire department actually thanked us for taking that precaution. So I appreciated that because sometimes the doctor's office gets sick of us. So,
yes, we know he sneezed. It's natural.
Right.
Yeah, well, good. Well, that's good. And actually, if you want to hear Meyer Tinley's take on this, you can go to MeyerTinley.com
and click on blog.
And click on blog. He's Josh's one-year-old who has his own blog and occasionally writes about the crazy antics of the Tinley household.
Yeah, he hadn't written much recently, but I told him he should probably talk about this.
Well, speaking of blogging like crazy, Joey's TV on the Fritz blog is taking off. He's posting like crazy lately, yeah. While I've been incredibly slacking over at Christian Dissent. But
it's taking off like a bandit in the night.
Of course, if you're looking for original content, TV on the Fritz isn't really the place to go. He's more of a cut-and-paste blogger, right?
I know. I'm like the Tennessean of bloggers.
So we have on the show for the second hour an author is going to come in, and his name is Rich. How do you guys would say that? Savin? S-A-V-I-N?
Savin
Williams. I'll have to ask him. I probably should have asked him on my email before.
That's the problem with email. You don't hear the pronunciation.
Right. But he wrote a book that came out a couple of months ago called The New Gay Teenager. It's available from Harvard Press. And if you remember, a few weeks ago, Time Magazine did a big article, The Battle Over Gay Teens, and a lot of that came from this mm-hmm. book.
That book, and also, what's his name, Chad Thompson,
yeah.
was also prominently interviewed, who's been a... He's been a former Christian Dissent guest, is why I mentioned his name.
Yeah.
I know you've had your...
Big time. Yeah. We are big time.
Chad Thompson is... and Chad and I have emailed back and forth. And for those of you who didn't hear the Chad Thompson show, that was actually the week before we went to the three-person format. He has an organization called Inquiry, and he's an ex-gay, young, attractive ex-gay. And though he's never had any homosexual experiences, he just had homosexual feelings. And then, and this is from what he told me, and then went on to become, you know, an ex-gay, and he has his whole thing is that he wants to sort of connect the church, rework how the evangelical church approaches gay people, even though we're still going to hell. But I don't know, Chad. I mean, I think he's a good guy at heart and is really trying to do what he thinks is right. But you know, of course, we have some fundamental disagreements over how we view the world and sexuality. So anyway,
but this guy's a little more the guy we have today on the other side of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. And a lot of people bring up and they ask, why do we talk about this so much? Why do we, you know, what does sexuality have to do with the church? And I think, honestly, with youth, one of the greatest mistakes the church has made is not to engage youth in true and honest discussion and dialogue about sexuality. Because as much as we want to look at children and youth or young teens and teenagers as sort of innocent, especially younger teens, as innocent non-sexual beings, the fact of the matter is that they are sexual.
Yeah, and I mean, puberty has in recent decades has started earlier,
right?
Mm-hmm. So I mean, and adulthood culturally has started later, so you have a much longer extended adolescence in
right.
which youth have to come to grips with all this,
and it's
very difficult. And
just because we don't address it doesn't mean it doesn't happen,
right? And I think the church has done a better job recently in at least attempting to address it, but I think they're still figuring out how to do that and tinkering around with that.
And the problem is that it's become such a loaded issue in that everything you teach is controversial, no matter what it is. You know, if you're teaching abstinence, well, that's controversial because you're not really, you know, addressing the whole issue. If
if you don't teach it, then it's controversial because it's perceived that you're
right. If you teach
condom
use, it's
premarital
right.
sex, and if yeah,
and but one of the premises of the book is that while we are all sitting up here trying to figure out how best to teach teens about sexuality, they've sort of figured it out on their own, and they're laughing at us and trying to figure out what the heck the big deal is. And that's, I mean, I think it's disturbing because I think, I don't know. I mean, I see churches and I see activists, you know, gay activist groups and different stuff who have just sort of missed this entire generation of kids. And it's really the kids who are just a little bit younger than what we are. And who they're not the trailblazers, because the trail was blazed pretty much right before they came out or came of age. And so now they're there, and I don't know, they just seem to perceive everything differently. So it's interesting to see how to talk with Rich, who does have a history in the church, along with being a psychologist at Cornell. Is that right? Cornell, yeah.
So he's an Ivy Leaguer.
He's an Ivy Leaguer.
And his book's published by Harvard Press.
Right.
So you can't.
However, he did get a master's degree from the University of Chicago Divinity School. So
is he a Presbyterian?
So he's a heretic.
Yeah. He's
no, I'm just kidding.
No, he. I think he came out of the Christian Church.
Disciples of Christ?
Yeah.
Well, while I'm thinking about it, a really good book I'm reading right now that kind of gives you some context. It doesn't really talk that much about sexuality. It touches on it, but it's not about that. But it's called Hurt. It's written by a guy named Chap Clark, who is he's a professor of youth ministry, but this isn't written necessarily for the church. It's more for the secular market.
Mm-hmm.
But what he says is that in recent years, and partly because our culture's definition of adulthood has shifted to where you become an adult much later, and just our culture's emphases have shifted, so that adults don't necessarily – they're not necessarily looking out for the best interests of youth when they're working with youth. They often have their own agendas. Like coaches are trying to obviously build their resumes,
right,
get a good winning percentage, win some championships. Not for the kids, not so the kids can have a good experience or build teamwork or camaraderie, but so that they can look good and maybe get a better job. You know, and the same thing with – say a youth minister trying to build a program, trying to bring more kids in and say, well, we have 200 kids on Sunday night. And it goes on and on. Principals obviously trying to get test scores and so forth, where the kids almost get this impression that they're being used, that this isn't a sincere effort to help them. But this is, it's all about the adults. So they develop these layers. And I mean, everything he says even resonated with me as somebody who's been out of high school for 10 and a half years. I could remember those same types of feelings, building those same types of layers, those same types of relationships. So the idea behind the book is there's kind of this underlying youth culture where adults are shut out and youth are kind of surround themselves, put themselves in a bubble. And just like you were saying, you know, they don't let adults in, so adults don't really know what's going on.
Right.
And they might pretend to, but even adults that are there working with kids every day often are shut out. And kids develop multiple personalities, which I can, again, identify with even my generation. You become a different person dealing with a parent, dealing
right.
with a coach, dealing with
your youth
a
minister.
Close friend, dealing with your youth minister, dealing with the popular kids at school, and so forth. You develop different layers, different personalities. And I think that gives a lot of context to some of the things we've talked about with sexuality and other things with young people in the church.
I mean, it's really interesting. Young people in the church thing, just because teenagers are great at figuring out what adults want to hear.
Yeah.
And telling it to them and pretty much convincing us.
Playing the game.
That we're the coolest people in the world and they love us. But the whole time they're laughing, you know, yeah. at us. And I mean, and one perfect example of this is that this recent controversy where this guy and this girl and this older guy met online, and then he went and killed her parents. And
oh, yeah.
She was, like, right there, and then they ran off together and they found him. But, you know, and part of the controversy in the magazines is that, oh, you know, these personal online personal stuff, which I have my own issues with. But if you read the girls online like, I don't know if it's MySpace or Zanga or whatever, you know, she talks about loving Jesus and being a good Christian, and, you know, and it's this, you know, flowery pink and white and, you know, sort of like, oh, she's such a good Christian girl. You know, this was a girl who, you know, invited this guy over to shoot her parents and then ran off with him. So obviously, I mean, she obviously had she knew what side to play where.
Yeah.
You know, she knew what people wanted to hear. And that's how, I mean, that's how a lot of teens are. And they're not all homicidal and such, but...
And a lot of teens who do, like online journals, whereas if I'm going to do it, I want as many people to read it as want to read it.
Right.
Where teens, generally, from what I've found, are a lot more likely to put password protection on it, so only a select group of people can view what they write.
Though there are a good number of sort of exhibitionist teenagers out there, which... And that is honestly what I find... The most disturbing, and what I think is actually one of the number one ways that adults exploit teenagers is that not only do we provide them with these sort of exhibitionist settings where you can go to like MySpace, which is a great, I mean, networking team. I have friends from college and part of my life that I've actually connected back with and email with. So, I mean, I recognize it and value it as a networking sort of communications tool. But if you go and you look at some of these things that, I mean, and again, whether it's girls or gay boys or straight boys, I mean, the things that they write, the pictures that they post, I mean, there's pictures of 16-year-olds in pretty provocative, you know, sort of like, here's my body, don't you want it, type poses and phrases. And I don't. We not only allow that as a culture, we encourage it. I mean, look at the media. Look at, go to the magazine rack at your local Borders.
But by that same token, does this book kind of encourage that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, and I'm going to think. I mean, to me, there's a. I don't know. There's got to be a way that we can encourage healthy expressions.
Yeah, because you want positive body image,
right?
You don't want to be prudish and try to pretend like sexuality doesn't exist, right, or shouldn't be expressed,
and you know, or shame. You know, yeah. That's what's got us to a lot of. I mean, that's what contributes to a lot of our problems. But there's also a sense of exploitation to MySpace because there are those creepy old guys, and it's usually right. Creepy old guys. I mean, just. It's from what I've seen.
You looked at me when you said that.
No, you're not a creepy old guy. No,
you're not old enough yet.
No, I mean, I'm talking, I mean, but there's, you know, I don't understand why, and I'll probably get hate mail for this, but I don't understand why if you're a 60-year-old guy from, say, Wyoming, that you've decided to join up on the friend profile of a 16-year-old from Tennessee who has all his poses with his shirt off, licking his tongue, you know, licking his lips or whatever, you know.
Licking his tongue.
Yeah, it's impossible, isn't it? You know, and say, ooh, you know, that's hot. I mean, that's, to me, that's not only gross and I think it's just morally unacceptable. Because even if you have that attraction, okay, even if you really are the 65-year-old man who's really attracted to the 16-year-old boy, you should have – you're an adult. This
right.
kid is 16, and, you know, there's all these issues. You should have the, state of mind to say, I'm not even going to engage this kid, even if it's a long-distance, just sort of flirty email thing. You should have that sort of, I'm grown up. This is a teenager, so I'm not going to engage this behavior. But we encourage this. I mean, look at XY Magazine, okay? XY Magazine, now, I would say that as a teenager, I read XY, and it's a gay magazine that is supposedly aimed towards gay teens, and a lot of gay teens read it, and it always has really provocative...
Now, the people that pose for it, are they teenagers or no?
That's never been made clear to me. I don't know if they're technically eight, you know, some are 18 or some are younger. There's ones that definitely look younger, and it's definitely skewed towards that. But it's even though it's aimed towards gay teens, I guarantee you there's more gay 40 year olds that read it than gay teenagers. And that bothers me because I think as adults, we should provide a space, again, for that healthy sexual expression and healthy sexual development without encroaching on it for our own sort of... thing. And not all adults do this, and not all women, but...
And, I mean, you've cited gay examples, but I mean, obviously, there's plenty of straight examples. I mean, you just, you know, like, pick a starlet, like, anybody... In late teens, early 20s, Olsen twins, Lindsay Lohan.
Yeah, or
Britney
Spears when she was younger. Yeah,
yeah, or like Natalie Portman when she was younger, or, you know, Hilary Duff, or any of them.
Dakota Fanning.
Oh, goodness. But they're, you know, they're people on the internet counting down until their 18th birthdays when they're legal and when all of a sudden they can feel less guilty about exploiting them.
Right.
Which I think is disturbing.
And then you look at the way that – I mean, you look at the self-image of teenage girls and the type of clothing. I'm sorry. I mean – and I'm not a prude, okay? I don't want to sound like a prude.
I don't know if you have to deny it that many times to start to wonder.
I'm a liberal guy, and I'm up for self-expression. And
down with it.
But, man, it's, you know, the six-year-olds with the short skirts, that's just a little bit icky for me. And the pageant stuff, that's icky too, you know?
That's icky for more reasons than sexual exploitation.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I am a prude. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe I'm a gay Republican conservative. Though it's the Republicans that have their daughters dressed like whores.
Well, it's lots of people. It's,
well, yeah, I mean, it's not just Republicans, but I can't. I don't.
Your log cabin membership will be coming.
I just don't get it. And again, I am 110% for kids being to express themselves and having a positive image. But I don't necessarily think that some of the stuff that we promote in our culture does that. I think it does more to encourage. I mean, it's encourage negative image. I don't know. Anyway, so
and I think the big thing underlying all of this, teenagers want meaningful relationships with adults. But it's becoming harder and harder for them to find those relationships, to forge those relationships, because adults have, in a sense, betrayed teenagers, and I mean the trust is not there.
Right.
And kids, even if they're not really fully developed in terms of abstract thinking and mental maturity, they can still understand who they can trust and who they can't trust.
Yeah.
And there's a sense that they cannot trust the average adult for some of the reasons we've talked about and for many other reasons. And I think that's the fundamental issue, because adults, honestly, too often want something more out of it. They don't just want to be buddies with these kids. They don't want to be mentors or teachers to these kids. They have something else going on. Something exploitative,
right? And I just want to tell the 65-year-old guy from Wyoming on MySpace. It's not really a person, but you all know who you are. You're not fooling anybody. I mean, the kid knows that you don't just want to be his buddy. Please.
I get a lot of MySpace inquiries from like women. They're like, "Come see me take off my shirt."
So, honey, you're barking up the wrong tree on that.
Is it? I mean, do they know you're gay though? I mean, is it?
It's just spam.
Yeah, they're spam.
Okay.
Well, I have been accused of being an anti-Semite. Have y'all kept up with that?
What did you do?
Well, online?
Yeah, online. Well, a week or so ago, I wrote, you know, because we have all these idiots whining about, yeah, Christmas, stealing Christmas. Wow. We have everything, all the money, all the power, but you're gonna steal Christmas. You know,
I think I know what you're talking. I think you're one of your more recent posts,
right? One of my recent posts, and I titled it in maybe a layer of irony and sarcasm, and just general, you know, being kind of jerkish. I titled it "Boy," and I thought the Jews had a persecution complex because, I want to use this. It went on. The post was online for quite a while, and it had a lot of responses. And anybody had responded to the title being offensive until last week. And you know, somebody said, "I can't believe you did that. That's, I mean, you think Jews are bad or something?" And then Catherine Coble, who is a nice girl,
a local blogger,
but who her and I usually end up on opposite end of things, but sometimes we do end up together. You know, then she said, chimed in and said, well, yeah, I think that was really offensive, but I didn't want to say anything. Is that offensive? You found it offensive? You're not Jewish. No.
But I found it offensive.
It caught me. Yeah, I wasn't sure about it. I mean, I was a little taken aback and a little...
Why didn't you say anything?
Oh, I just
are you guys just going to let me like burn out there? Let me just, you know...
Sorry, I just didn't... I don't know.
Drive off
the... I think like what you said, the discussion was going on and nobody else seemed to be making note of it. So I thought it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing.
It was a tongue-in-cheek thing. And that's... and I don't feel like I... And I tried to explain it to them, what the meaning was. And I went back and forth whether or not I wanted to write a lengthy justification post and post it on the blog. But even though I don't necessarily feel like I have to justify it, because one, I think it's obviously in humor. If you read the title and you read the post,
sarcasm is hard to come across online,
right? But I think if you read Christian Dissent and you read what I write. And you, especially, and if you listen, especially if you listen to the show.
Right.
But I think if you read most of what I write and you read the actual post, because I don't think I mentioned the Jews ever again in that entire thing. And I think it's pretty obvious that it's said in jest. And I don't think that you should, I mean, it's making fun of the stereotype. Yes, it cites the stereotype, but in sarcasm it makes fun of it because, you know, guys, Jews are the persecuted people. You know, that's the story in the Bible, right? You know, the chosen ones,
I mean,
they face persecution, right?
Their forebears were...
Right, yeah. and that's a big part of the faith, is the persecution that their ancestors faced, you know, in, you know, that's a big part of the Jewish story. But so I don't think inciting that is necessarily a racist or anti-Semitic actions, and especially when doing it in jest. And I think we watch our language too much, and I think that actually makes things worse because it precludes a lot of dialogue and just makes people defensive. But I'm sorry. I mean, I'm sorry if I offended anyone. Of course, I don't think anybody I offended was actually Jewish.
Do we have any Jewish listeners?
Who knows? I don't know why. I imagine the show would be very boring unless they just want to laugh at Christians, which is probably what you know, is happening. So everybody's not Christian listening to this show. It's like, oh, those crazy Christians.
Those crazy gay lovers.
Those crazy gay loving Christians. But if I'm sorry if you're offended by it, but I'm not sorry I said it because I know I didn't say it in hate I didn't say it in hate or with malice or with any real intent to try to blame Jews for being persecuted or something. I don't know. Anyway, I'm sorry you're offended, but don't read me anymore if you got a problem with it. You know, buzz off. Come on, guys. You got to help me move past this. We got to move to something else. You just silent over there. Am I off base here? Am I just completely out of line? It's okay to contradict me if you think I'm wrong. I'm not going to turn.
I mean,
your mic
I might
down.
Not do it again.
well, no, it wouldn't be funny to do it again. Okay.
This just sounds like something Ann Coulter would say.
Okay, now I will never do it again. Thank you very much. Well, here's my defense of Ann Coulter.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. I think Ann Coulter is an annoying person. I don't think that she should... I think it's wrong to take her seriously as a news person. Okay?
She's like the Michael Moore of the right.
Right. She's a clown. Ann Coulter is a clown, and when you take her as a clown... She's funny, okay? I mean, she's like an off-color, offensive comedian. And comedians use offensive, you know, some of the really funny... I mean, Richard Pryor, actually, who just passed away.
Yes.
I mean, that guy was offensive. But he was funny about it. And there's a lot of comedians out there. Who's that funny-looking guy on King of Queens?
Kevin James.
No, the funny-looking one.
Patton Oswalt.
Patton Oswalt, yeah. I mean, that guy just... insults people you know, and tries to make as many people mad as he can with his comedy act. But in the context of a comedy act, it's funny, right? Instead of, like, if it was just on the street corner and he was yelling it, it would be offensive. So you take Ann Coulter in the context of what she is, which is a clown, then, you know, she's funny. She says some funny things, and, you know, and she really, you know, there are some hypocrisies that liberals have, that we have, you know, that in our, in what we say.
Yeah, and I think it's silly to get worked up about Ann Coulter, because, I mean,
you can't take her seriously.
I don't think she has. I mean, people obviously buy her books and so forth, but she doesn't have the sway or the power,
right,
that
people buy Bill Cosby's books.
Right.
I mean, she is a clown, and as a clown, she really is. I mean, if you look at some of her writings and some of her sayings, and some of it's worse than others, but if you look at it in like a purely humor analysis, it's funny. So, anyway, I don't like her.
And we do like Jewish people.
We do like Jewish people. Because without Jewish people, there would be no Christians.
See, and then you could start to get into all kinds of layers there.
I know.
As well.
No. We like everybody here. I mean, we're not. You know, if you think we're the anti-Semite Christians, you're turning to the wrong station.
Except Republicans. I'm just kidding.
Because there are plenty of those out there, but
and Jewish people have been persecuted, and
right, and that's
the
thing.
There are some plenty of false stereotypes about Jewish people, and
yeah.
I understand what you're saying.
Speaking of guilt, my gosh.
Yeah, I'm a wuss.
He didn't even write it. He didn't write it or say anything about it, and he's like guilty for me over here.
No, I just want to show that we're, you know, I don't know.
I honestly don't think there's anybody out there who seriously thinks that I'm an anti-Semite. And if there is, I'm sorry, you're just an idiot.
Lovely. Name calling. How Christianly of you.
Did you invent that? That's a new word, Christianly.
I know, it's a good word.
Is it an adverb? Is it a real word? You're the...
I don't know that it's a real word, but if it were a real word, it would be in...
You're an editor. You have poetic license.
Yeah, I can create new words.
You can create new words.
New terms.
Let's create that word.
Christianly.
Christianly. Well, speaking of Christianly, I saw... I don't want to take up everything because if you guys have other things, but I saw The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
The Chronicles of Narnia.
The Chronicles of Narnia. And I want to say this, and I think it's important because you guys have heard it here first. You heard it here first on Christian Descent Live. That movie is going to be a hit.
Really?
Yeah. I think I can say that safely after seeing it, that movie's really going to fill the theaters there.
Now,
so
it has Christian allegories because the lion dies and he's like Jesus or something?
Yeah.
The story in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is very parallel to the story of Christ. And then you get into the other six Narnia books, and there are other... I don't know, fairly explicit parallels between the Christian story and the Narnia stories.
But here's my thing. I don't get it, the difference between Harry Potter and the Chronicles of Narnia.
Is Harry Potter like Jesus or something?
No, I mean, Harry Potter's evil, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Because he uses magic, but you know
and
what?
He's gay, too.
But you, well, yeah, according to the Shadowmancer guy, But Narnia is all about magic, right? The old magic, and there's witches. Of course, the witch is clearly evil, but in the Narnia book. But is there a difference between the magic of Harry Potter, that's the evil black magic, and then the magic of the Chronicles of Narnia?
I think it. Honestly, I think a lot of it comes down to the faith and some of the other writings and expressions of the author. And I think you can throw Lord of the Rings into this too, because obviously, you know, Lord of the Rings by itself seems I'm surprised there wasn't a big uproar about that, except that J.R.R. Tolkien was a openly Christian person who said that his faith influenced his writing. And then C.S. Lewis, obviously a renowned Christian theologian before he got into fiction, So I think a lot of that, because J.K. Rowling, who writes the Harry Potter books, has not really talked about faith at all. I mean, as far as you can tell, she's a kind of an agnostic seeker, maybe nominally a Christian, but not really, type, who doesn't really get into her faith very much. And I think that has a lot to do with it. As far as I can tell, it's the what people perceive as the intent of the writer. Because, I mean, I think the Harry Potter story, you have a kind of an orphan, a person whose origins are fuzzy, who, there's very much a Christ story going on through there,
right.
who has to overcome temptation, who is, you know, in a sense has this baptism, this initiation ritual, when he starts his career. And I don't know. And there's a lot of Christian themes like sacrifice and other things that come up over and over again. And I personally, I find more meaning in the Harry Potter stories, because I think the Narnia stories, Lewis was too bound by Christian theology and trying to fit everything into this Christian paradigm that he wasn't really able to fully explore Narnia as a place, as a alternate reality. Whereas I think Harry Potter's much more creative and really develops the characters a lot better.
Well, I mean, and I would agree. I mean, as works of literature, I think Lord of the Rings is by far better than the Chronicles of Narnia.
Oh yeah, I think so too. I don't think it's great literature. But then again, it's written. They were intended to be children's books.
Mm-hmm.
Where Harry Potter, the kind of intended to be children's books that would increase in age as the kids who read the first one grew up, and then Lord of the Rings, which is obviously more, you know, at least
right.
young adult. So,
well, here's my great fear.
Uh-oh.
With the Chronicles of Narnia, and I already see it happening. It's that we're sort of having this cult of Lewis develop, and actually people. And I've had this, like, I've been in like, religious debates online, and somebody said, well, that's not what C.S. Lewis thought, you know?
Yeah.
Why don't we ask C.S. Lewis? Like, what? I mean, yeah, C.S. Lewis does have some important works, and you know, beyond the Chronicles of Narnia in Christian literature. But, I mean, he was hardly Jesus, or even John Wesley. I mean...
Yeah, kind of a peculiar guy.
Yeah. And I just, you know, I think we're going to end up seeing that. Because the problem with the current church, and when I say this, like the current people in power of the church, they're really bad about seeing, ooh, well, this is something sparkly. Let's grab, you know, let's chase after it and forget about everything else. We got to go after sparkly C.S. Lewis over here. He's got a good movie. And so we've got to make sure that everything we do is around that. And then you lose perspective with Talking Lions.
And with Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, the story's pretty benign. It's the Christian story. It's Jesus, basically. As you get into those other, because as far as I know, they're making all seven movies.
Based on the fact that they sold out like every show yesterday. Yeah.
Yeah. As you get into some of those other ones, like the, you know, the Calormenes and some of the other books they're Muslims basically. Mm-hmm. And they're the enemies from the South, from, you know, they're dark skinned and you get some things into his treatment of women that have raised questions before. And I mean, honestly, all this is, you can find all this on the internet, but I mean, I read all the Narnia books in the last year and without having read anything about them since I was like 9, going into this fresh, I could tell, okay, those are the Muslims. Okay, that is very questionable what he's saying and doing here. This device is very misogynist. But without it reading any commentary to send me in that direction,
right.
I thought it really stuck out. So I think those kind of controversies are going to come up as some of these other movies are made.
What does he do that's misogynist?
Well, they actually took it out. It was like the one, you know, this is man's work or that's woman's work and that type of stuff. And
Yeah, I mean, there's part of it's cultural because, I mean, these were written in the late 40s, early to mid 50s. Mm-hmm. And there is a, I mean, there's definitely patriarchy at work. But the, I mean, the big controversy in Narnia is Susan, not to spoil this for people who just saw the first movie and haven't read the other stories.
Spoiler warning.
Spoiler alert. In the end, when they go to heaven, which is kind of a super Narnia type place in the final book, Susan doesn't get in.
Yeah, she's an unbeliever.
Because, and kind of the reasons given for that is she stopped believing in Narnia or stopped caring about Narnia because she got into boys and makeup and stuff like that. I mean, there's, you know, basically, yeah. I mean, there's, yeah, there's a fear of sex in it, and there's, and I think that definitely comes down harder on women. So,
as always has for some reason. But it's a beautiful movie, by the way. And I mean, I'd go see it.
Yeah, and I mean, all the book, they're good stories, and there's a lot. I don't think Lewis was a bad guy, but I think there are some underlying cultural things from the 50s.
He was a product of the culture.
That today would raise some red flags.
Things in the Bible that...
Right. You know. And I'm not saying I'm going to be protesting some of these later movies or anything, but I'm saying these are going to raise eyebrows, and it'll be interesting to see how the church deals with this.
I'm going to make fun of Josh here for a second.
Okay.
I can just see you protesting anything.
I'm not a good protester.
I'm protesting, but I'm sorry. I mean, go see the movie. But you know, I'm protesting here. I'm picketing, but you know, I'll go over here then. Let me get out of your way.
Yeah, I'm not a good protester. I get very uncomfortable
because he apologizes. I
apologize way too much.
Yeah, even for me, he apologizes for me.
Yeah, I know.
It's great though. I guess I probably need that.
It's
otherwise,
because I'm a lot of pressure. I feel bad because I don't want it to sound like I'm upset with anything you say. I just...
No, go right
ahead. If there's something that, you know, might upset people, I just...
Go right ahead. I need
try
that.
To, because I try to...
You're a good balance for me, because I...
Round
you know,
off the
I
edges
just,
a little bit.
I just, you know, I just... My mouth just shoots off, and I bulldoze. Well,
like, yeah, speaking of me being a wuss, I actually agreed with IRD this week.
Who's IRD?
It's Mark Tooley's people.
The Institute
on IRD.
Religion and Democracy.
The Institute that replaced democracy with religion.
Because, and I think this is a question that's been on my mind a lot lately, especially since we've been doing this show and we've talked to a lot of people. They were upset with five denominational leaders. Jim Winkler of the United Methodist Church's General Board of Church and Society, and then equivalent leaders and like Presbyterian Church USA, United Church of Christ, and a couple other denominations for being... not just for being critical of the current budget that's going through the houses of Congress, but for how they were, you know, openly critical of certain things, and basically making the case that it was a very, I don't know, they were very much in line with the Democratic Party, and IRD was upset that they were not being true to their constituents in the churches. And as much as I don't think IRD and myself would agree on a budget at all. That is something I worry about. How do you speak on behalf of a denomination as large as some of these denominations are, on behalf of a church that has many diverse opinions, that has Republicans and Democrats and everything else? Because I think even though I would disagree with the Republican way of helping America's needy, of getting the poor off their feet and to some level of self-sufficiency and independence and, you know, to feed the hungry, to get people health care and so forth. I would disagree with their way of doing that, but I don't doubt their sincerity. Well, I guess it depends on the person, but a lot of them, I don't doubt their sincerity. I think they're really trying to do what's best for people. I don't necessarily think it works all the time, and they won't think what I would advocate works. But my point is, as a denominational leader, if you've got people with these differing perspectives that you're trying to represent, should you instead focus on the things that everybody can agree on, that, okay, I don't care how you do it, but you have to demonstrate that caring for the poor, the sick, the oppressed, the hungry is a priority in this budget one way or another.
Right.
And not getting specific, saying this cut, this increase, and so forth is immoral, but just saying, being clear to the senators, you need to demonstrate that you care about our most vulnerable citizens. And I wonder about that. Is that sanitizing things too much? Is it watering it down? Because my other fear is, if we don't water it down a little bit and get a little more broad with our approach, we're going to really alienate a lot of people.
Well, I mean, to me, that's the problem. To me, our battle, and I hate to use that term, but the argument shouldn't be waged in Congress. I think we need to do more to engage church members in this type of dialogue.
Before we go to Congress.
Right.
Well, there needs to be another level.
The voice of the church needs to be the people of the church. And yes, there are a lot of people in the church, especially the churches that I'm a member of, that disagree with me. But I think we should all be, both liberal and conservative, should all be more active in the sort of church's influence over social issues. And when I mean that, I want to clarify that I'm pretty much talking about like poverty and stuff.
Right.
Though important social issues, I should say, because granted we get tied up in a lot of social issues that are just stupid.
Ridiculous.
Yes. So, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to ask, how did you exactly agree with the IRD?
Well, I just agreed with their criticism of these leaders for speaking out in the manner that they spoke out. Even though I probably agreed with what the leader's perspective was, I didn't think they should have gone to the government and openly said these things in the way that they
right.
did.
And I think that especially in our church, United Methodist Church, I think that the Board of Church and Society should be doing, and they do a lot of work inside the church.
They do a lot of good work, but some of the things they do make me a little uncomfortable.
I mean, I think we need to push that sort of social gospel of helping the poor, the downtrodden. It needs to be pushed more within our own churches. Because especially as we've gotten to more of the mega churches, or as I like to say, future convention centers, because the mega churches won't be around for long, at least not all of them. I think that we really need to pull our focus back on the missions of Jesus, which was beyond just saving people, really working with the lowest in society, which is something that our churches don't do enough of.
And another thing I want to say, though, I will reject a comment I hear a lot from people that the church should not be lobbying the government at all, that Christians do not need to be writing letters to their senators. They need to instead be giving money to charities and volunteering with different community organizations, because I think the government has a fundamental role to play
right.
in lifting people out of poverty and ensuring that people have health care. The church cannot just – there's not the resources there for the church to do this on its own. And I think people would raise the point – or people have raised the point to me on several occasions that you look back at Jesus isn't lobbying the government. But it's a much different situation, because Jesus was living under Roman occupation in a pretty insignificant little province on the fringe of the empire, where we're living in a country where our leaders claim to be Christians, where the majority of the people are somehow people of some Abrahamic faith and have this prophetic tradition of helping the poor. And so I think in this case, you know, we do have the power. We do have access to the power. So we should use that
right.
to help the people who need it most.
Instead of helping ourselves, which really seems...
Which is easy to do in our culture, because that's just how it's set up. And I think we do need to involve the government. I think that's very important. And again, people have different views on the best way to do that. And I'm not going to claim to have the answers, but I am very adamant that the government has a role to play, and that we need to petition them and write them, and you know, and in that way, I think what these church leaders are doing is good. I just want them to be careful not to alienate people in the process.
Right. Well, that's important.
So I've babbled a lot here, so I apologize. I don't know how any of this translated over the radio. See, there I go. I'm a wuss. I don't even.
Speaking of poor communication, people have accused, again, the same week that I was accused of being an anti-Semite.
You're having a rough week.
Yeah. I've been accused of trying to destroy the Christian faith because I tried.
Well, you might be doing that.
Well, yeah, it's possible. But because of, you know, I pointed out some issues in the Christmas story, you know, things that are mentioned here but not mentioned here.
Oh, yeah, that post, too. I was very offended by that.
You were very offended by that. You know, and the basic argument against that was, and yes, some of those points, and I knew what the stuff was, but for help in writing, I copied and pasted a lot of stuff in that post, but I did do it with crediting the source.
Okay, good.
You plagiarized with crediting.
Yes. Actually, I wrote a paragraph, and then I said, below this is from such and such. But, you know, so I didn't agree with all the points. Some of the points were stronger than others. But the fact is that in the Bible, there are some historical, you could almost call them inaccuracies, or historical leeway, or sort of things given. But I don't think that you have to take the Bible literally to take it seriously, or to even say it's... maybe the Bible is inerrant, but doesn't mean that I have to take it literally for it to be inerrant. I mean, I don't understand why people would be so opposed for the Christmas story, which is a beautiful story. And the one that we know is a combination of Gospels, but is a beautiful story and has great symbolism, much like the Chronicles of Narnia, and, you know, really gets the point across in that I respect and love and you know, cherish the Christmas story. However, maybe it's a parable, you know?
Yeah, I mean, because you don't have... It's not like the writers of the Gospels of Matthew and Luke could go to the library and get the copy of the Jerusalem Times for that day, right, when that happened, and check their...
Savior of the world is born.
Yeah, it's not like they can... It's... I mean, we assume, I think, that the writers in biblical times had the same resources available to them that we do now, but they didn't. They had to reconstruct things. And a lot of times the way they reconstructed was by looking at their own faith tradition and fitting what they're writing about into this overarching narrative. And
these people weren't there.
I mean, by necessity, they had to take some liberties. They had to reconstruct things that we don't know exactly how these things happened. And there are some historical questions that get raised, and I agree with you that that's not something that should offend us. I think it's, you know, I think the story has merit in itself,
right,
regardless of exactly how it happened. And I don't think, I don't think it matters how Jesus was born or came to earth. I don't think that affects who he was or what he did, because... I mean, if you believe in a powerful God, God can get that done in a number of ways. If it didn't happen that specific way,
yeah,
it's not that big of a deal.
I mean, nobody that was at the birth of Jesus wrote about it.
That's true.
And we don't even know if anybody who wrote about it actually talked to anybody who was there.
And most people were illiterate too, so they would have had no way to write it down.
Right.
So this, anything that is accurate was carried down orally over many years.
And again, I don't see why that, by bringing that, I mean, I think giving the story the intellectual honesty that it deserves is respecting the story. I mean, people accuse me of being disrespectful to the Christmas story, to the Bible, but I think it's disrespectful to turn a blind eye to the truth. That's disrespect. To say that the story can't stand otherwise than how you've felt it, you know, unless it's 100% this or that, is disrespectful to the story and really negates its power as a story. But it's beautiful. I respect it. I love it. I love Christmas. It's really one of my favorite times of year. Even though Christ was not born on December 25th, I celebrate the life of Christ on that day, even though some churches won't be because they'll be closed.
Right, that's something we can talk about next week.
Oh, that's just awful. But I mean, it's an important part of my life, but I still see it as what it is, and I embrace the symbolism, and in my worship and in my, you know, meditation on the season. I mean, that's important to me. But
And I think there are two points that are important to make here. I think one is, when you are honest historically, the writers of the Bible, for a lot of the narratives that are recorded, were not eyewitnesses and had to reconstruct it using tools that would not be accepted by modern scholarship. They're not doing the research in the way we could do research today and get something right. On the other hand, I don't think the biblical writers are trying to deceive anyone.
No.
They're not creating false narratives. They're not, they're not just trying to make something up and pull one on people. I think it's, and even if things take a certain turn for the poetic, for the dramatic, maybe the writers knew it probably didn't happen that way, but it gives it more of a sense of beauty. We see this all through a modern lens, and if you go back to antiquity and the way things were done then, it's just a totally different perspective on writers of the Bible. For a lot of the narratives that are recorded, were not eyewitnesses and had to reconstruct it using tools that would not be accepted by modern scholarship. They're not doing the research in the way we could do research today and get something right. On the other hand, I don't think the biblical writers are trying to deceive anyone.
No.
They're not creating false narratives. They're not just trying to make something up and pull one on people. I think it's, and even if things take a certain turn for the poetic, for the dramatic, maybe the writers knew it probably didn't happen that way, but it gives it more of a sense of beauty. We see this all through a modern lens, and if you go back to antiquity and the way things were done then, it's just a totally different perspective on scholarship, on fact, on everything. And I think you have to be honest with that. Same thing with, and we got a break coming up here, so I'll get this in really quick. But same thing with Paul's speeches and Acts and other things. There wasn't anybody there with a tape recorder. And it was very common practice in antiquity for people to reconstruct speeches based on what they knew about somebody, but then to make the speeches probably a lot more poetic and mm-hmm. concise than they actually were for purposes of the writing. So I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think nobody's saying there's any any trickery or anything like that. So anyways.
We're just trying to be honest about it, and what's wrong with that?
Some of this stuff is frustrating because you're just trying to have an honest intellectual discussion about something that's important, and people don't even want to hear it because it somehow is different than what they were taught. And they're smart people, and I just don't get it. Anyway, you're listening to Christian Dissent Live on WRFN, Pasco, Tennessee, Radio Free Nashville. Visit us at radiofreenashville.org. Okay, we're going to take a break now. We'll be right back, and we'll have our guest, Rich Savin Williams, the author of The New Gay Teenager. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Don't cry. You can rely on me, honey. You can combine anything you want. I'll be around. You write about the stars. Each one is a setting sun. Tall buildings shake, voices escape, singing sad, sad songs, tuned to chords strung down your cheeks, bitter melodies turning your orbit around. Don't cry, you can rely on me, honey. You can come by anytime. time you want. I'll be around. You write about the stars. Each one is a setting sun. Tall buildings shake, voices escape, singing sad, sad songs. Tuned to chords strung down your cheeks, bitter melodies turning your orbit around. Voices whine, skyscrapers are scraping together. Your voice is smoking and last cigarettes. All you can get, turning your orbit around. Out of, out of, out of is all we have. Is a burning sun. Tall buildings shake, voices escape, singing sad, sad songs. Tuned to chords strung down your cheeks, bitter melodies turning your orbit around. Voices whine, skyscrapers are scraping together. Your voice is smoking last cigarettes. All you can get, turning your orbit around. Last cigarettes, all you can get, turning your orbit around. Last cigarettes, all you can get, turning.
That was Wilco.
Wilco? Okay, and you're back on Christian.
You just jump into that. You don't even give time to say who it was that was playing.
Wilco Christian Descent Live here, and we have, I don't care who they are.
Well, if people are interested in the music.
Yeah, right.
They want to purchase the CD.
Okay, it's Wilco. What's the name of the album?
Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
Okay. Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
And anyway, we can link to that on our website.
On the on the phone, we have the author of The New Gay Teenager from Harvard University Press and a professor at Cornell, Rich Savin-Williams. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Well, I'm still warming up here in Ithaca.
It's cold?
Yes. Definitely cold.
It's cold. It's cold here too.
Do you have any snow up there?
Oh, just only about 4 or 5 inches. So,
wow,
that's as much as we've gotten in the last 15 years combined here.
Yeah, in Tennessee, we're not very well. When it snows like 1 inch, and the world comes to an end,
right? Everybody freaks out.
So anyway, I'm glad that you could be on this morning. You wrote a book called The New Gay Teenager, which explores sexuality in teens today and sort of how it's different than what we all thought. Tell us a little bit about the book, why you did it, and what you found out.
Well, it seems to me that over the years, most of the research that has been done on youth with same-sex attractions has been done by medical people or clinical-oriented people. So there's this image of gay youth suicide or depression or victimization. And it seemed to me that while that might have characterized a different generation, that today's youth are actually experiencing a very, very different world than the older generations have. So I wanted to sort of present in a way their world, which is an increasing visibility of homosexuality and also an ability for many of these kids growing up to feel very comfortable with their same-sex sexuality and find out that many of their peers feel the same way, that it's not such a big deal as it has been in previous generations.
And that's, I mean, that's an interesting thing, and I'd say that it hits close to home, at least for me, because when I was in high school, and I came out in 11th grade, and I was really one of the, I was the only person out at the time and one of the first people out in my high school.
In your state of Arkansas.
Yeah, in the state of Arkansas. And so there was a definite, you know, I had to sort of fight for some stuff. And according to your book, kids aren't having to do that anymore, are they?
Well, they do still have to, and I'm not, I would never say that the world is now perfect and
right.
we can stop and go away. But it does feel like there has been a real significant shift, and it does seem to me that that although in places like the Midwest, I grew up in Missouri, mm-hmm. that clearly that's not there are unsafe communities or there are unsafe places to be gay. But on the other hand, there's a way in which a lot of their peer group feel very comfortable with it and sort of say it's no big deal. You know, there are data that indicate that of any age group, that it is high school kids who would vote in favor of same-sex marriage. And that's not just on the East Coast and West Coast. You know, that's also true in the Midwest. And it's the only age group in which that kind of support would be there for same-sex marriage. And when you ask kids, straight kids, like, why would you favor same-sex marriage? They say, well, why not? Who cares? No big deal. You know, it has no bearing on me, and they have a right to get married just as much as I do. So that, I mean, that is a tremendous shift from when maybe you guys were in high school, when certainly when I was in high school, when we couldn't even see the word homosexuality. I had no concept of it.
Mm-hmm.
And now every kid growing up, I mean, when I talk with college classes and I ask how many of you know someone who's gay, lesbian, or bisexual, 100% raise their hand, 100%. Now, when I ask the other question, which is how many of you have a close personal friend or a family member who is gay, lesbian, or bisexual, I'd say at least a third of the class raises their hand. Now, that's an incredible shift. That is that kind of visibility. So it's like, yeah, sure, I know someone. Yeah, my best friend's gay, so what?
Right. Well, and one of the things your book talks about is sort of what it is to be gay
right.
With teens, and that it's a lot different than what... you know, when I was growing up and going through all this coming out, you know, there's a big, you know, queer youth or gay youth and you know, trying to make things right for them. But now it's sort of gay youth see themselves differently than what we think they see themselves as.
Well, you're right. And I think what's happening is that for many kids, they feel so comfortable with their sexuality that they don't want to make their sexuality the essence of who they are. That is... There's a way in which they say, you know, I'm many different things, and the fact that I'm attracted to other girls is true, but don't define me on the basis of my sexuality. You know, I'm a poet, or I'm an artist, or I'm a scientist. I'm a daughter, or I'm a son. And I think it's a way in which their sexuality is important to them. I'm not saying it's not, but a lot of them now, of the kids, are rejecting the terms, the categories, the boxes that we put them in and say, you know, get over it already. You know, yes, I have same-sex attractions. Yes, I'm dating her. Yes, I'm having sex with him. But that doesn't mean that you know something important about me. That is, there's something far more about me than just simply who I fall in love with. And I think that that is a real shift. I certainly know in college a lot of kids define themselves almost on the basis of their queer activism. And that's okay. I'm not saying I'm not against them. I'm not saying that's not good. But there's also this incredible number of people who would go see Brokeback Mountain, but who would never go to a gay event, so that they want to see same-sex sexuality on film, but it's not that they, you know, that they want to be politically active or they want to identify themselves as a gay person. And I don't think that's all internalized sort of homophobia, if you will.
Oh, I was wondering about what you thought about the whole Zach Stark coverage in the media's portrayal of Zach Stark.
I'm sorry, of what?
Of Zach Stark,
the free Zach. Did you ever
come across
Love
that?
In Action?
I'm not quite understanding yet what you're referring to.
Oh, okay.
Well, there was something, and it got a little bit of national media attention. There was a teenage boy who had a blog on the MySpace site,
His name was Zach Stark, and then he was put into Love in Action, the ex-gay program.
Oh, yes, yeah. Okay. Now I understand what you're talking about. Right, and actually that's been some of the sort of the increased visibility, but you see, that what's interesting to me is that kid definitely didn't feel that, that's what he wanted, and yet there clearly was on the part of adults. I mean, and that was sort of part of this whole Time Magazine October 10th issue, the battle over gay teens, when it's like adults sort of fighting over the soul, if you will, at times, of gay teenagers, while for the teenagers, it's not a battleground. They feel comfortable, and they don't quite understand why parents or adults are having such a dilemma over this and trying to get them into ex-gay groups or that any of those sorts of things, because for them, it's not such a big deal.
Well, and one of the interesting things about the Zach Stark issue was that it turned out that he, people tried to make him into sort of a cause celeb for the movement, and then he came out of the program and said, "Hey, I'm okay, but I don't want this to be my life, so I'm just gonna forget about it and go on and be a teenager," which disappointed some people, but was a very interesting reaction and sort of typical of what your book says these kids are. This, I'm not going to let this define me, even though my parents tried to define it, use it to define me, and all these people did. I'm not going to. It's on the ex-gay issue, which is something that we deal a lot with here on the show. One of the things that they use, and I think the ex-gay sort of community is sort of running scared right now because they're seeing this change in attitudes, and so they're really ramping up some of their publicity. But one of the things that they use, one of their favorite methods of trying to convince parents to put their kids in is sort of saying, well, it's all about how you're raised, and they have these sort of the father abandonment, exotic becomes erotic,
yeah.
This type of attitude. And your book sort of says that a lot of that, there's a lot of gay teenagers out there who don't fit those stereotypes that people use to, sort of do this kid is going to be pre-gay unless we get him into the program.
Exactly. And that's been sort of the whole basis of sort of the some of the James Dobson kinds of things on rearing boys. That is, you've got to be careful if any boy looks to be different or sensitive. And it's almost like our boys are not supposed to be sensitive. They're not supposed to be kind. Otherwise, they'll be gay. But I think that the ex-gay movement is extraordinarily frightened right now because the whole youth movement is going against them. Because most gay kids, an increasing amount of the population, believe that you don't choose your sexuality, that there is a biological genetic component, and all of the science points in that direction. It's not that it's absolutely been confirmed that we know what the genes are, what the hormones are, but it's very clear that 95% of all research on the origins of sexual orientation, just not homosexuality, but also heterosexuality and all the in-between sexualities, is very clearly sort of a biological genetic component. And it's going to be very difficult for the ex-gay movement to try to convince people to go against their natural selves. And I think that's the resistance they're running up against. So part of the investigation done by the reporter John McLeod of Time Magazine was actually to attend one of these kinds of ex-gay movement, Love in Action kinds of events. And he discovered that the kids are just sort of laughing about this, and some go in order to find a boyfriend. Other kids go because their parents tell them, and they think, okay, it's sort of a week off, and I get to meet some interesting people. But almost very few of the kids actually go there to change or to think that they can change. And they have no intent to change because, quite frankly, most kids with same-sex attractions, if they had a pill that would change them, wouldn't take the pill. They're happy having their same-sex attractions. Yes, they know their life is a little bit more difficult, but they don't give up their religion. They don't give up their family. They don't give up their interest. And indeed, a fair number of them say, well, this is what's unique about me. This is what I like, that I'm a little off. I'm not part of the mainstream. So So I think the ex-gay movement is going to have a real difficult time with this younger generation. And indeed, to indicate that, their focus, which used to be on, you know, you're going to hell, you're going to face this horrible life, they're now taking a kinder, gentler approach.
Right.
You know, like, oh, we love gay people. You know, Jesus loves you. And so they're sort of saying, well, we'll kill them with kindness. And many of them are also beginning to say, okay, we're not going to change your sexual orientation, but through the love of Jesus Christ, you can change who you have sex with. So, and that is true. I mean, you can, you know, you can be totally attracted to other boys and only have sex with girls. That could be a choice that someone has. And if that's what religion means, which is to go against your natural sexuality, then perhaps that's a choice. But the ex-gay people are really beginning to back off, I think in large part because the science is there and the kids are saying, hey, this is not going to go away.
Hi, Rich. This is Josh, and I'm the heterosexual on the show.
Okay.
I'm heterosexual, but not by choice. And I was wondering about the another aspect of this among the, I guess, straight teenagers, right. Non-gay teenagers. They have, by and large, become much more accepting of homosexual, bisexual peers. And I was wondering what you thought was driving that. What's the source of that? Why is that shift taking place? And how significant is the shift? Am I overestimating here?
I think you're not. It's impossible to overemphasize it. It is incredibly there. It's taking place. It's, I think, in large part, it's our culture. The youth culture has taken such a dramatic shift. I sort of attribute it to the real world syndrome. When you really look at the various real world episodes on was it HBO or whoever does
MTV.
It? MTV. Thank you. That what you see is that some of the most lovable, the kindest, the best looking kids on the show have been, you know, gay or lesbian or bisexual, and it's the ones who don't accept them which are portrayed as being really off or having problems. And you can actually catch that as they interview some of the straight people, kids on the show. They go, well, yeah, okay, I know I should be more loving and more accepting, but I just feel uncomfortable with it. So it's those individuals which are being portrayed as sort of the problematic people. So I really think that the youth culture in the songs, in the movies, in the magazines, there's just this total shift of emphasis. And in many ways, a lot of the gay kids that are being portrayed are very, very attractive and very normal and very sort of typical. And I think as a result, it's the kids are saying, oh, yeah, okay, I'd kind of like to be like her, or I'd like to be like him. And I think as more role models come out, I almost hate to use the word role models, but certainly other people who have come out, and you can see a diversity of expression. So it's not just the typical sissy boy or the dykish girl who have same-sex attractions. Yes, they do, but there are quarterbacks, there are cheerleaders, there are scientists who have same-sex attractions. And for the kids, it's sort of like, seems normal to me.
Do you think that there's an over-sexualization of teenagers? I mean, we've talked about this earlier in the show with, you know, Britney Spears, you know, a few years ago in the short skirt and the Catholic schoolgirl uniform. And then with gay culture, we have XY magazine where these kind of right at 18-year-olds are posing in provocative pictures. What do you think our obligation is to youth in that, and how does that apply to your book as you see it?
Well, certainly the sexualization of teenage years and youth has been longstanding. It's getting much greater, and certainly it is also true for same-sex attracted youth, too. It certainly is the case that there's a lot of media attention placed to that. I'm not ever sort of fond of that. I'm not anti-sex by any means, and I'm... And I would encourage people to do whatever it is that, you know, well, okay, we'll get into that. But, I mean, to follow at least some of their natural instincts rather than sort of stop them and abstain from everything until they're 21. But I also believe, and I think this has been part of the shift, and that is that homosexuality is not just about sex. It's about romance. And there was this one really interesting study done that was done with straight and gay high school kids. And basically it said, what is sexual orientation? And what the kids came up with is it's not who you have sex with, because you can have, you can choose to have sex with, you know, with a lot of different kinds of people and so forth, and genders. But it's who you romantically fall in love with and who you want to spend your time with. Now, this is amazing to me that it's sort of like kids have taken, in part, the sexuality out of homosexuality and have put into it romance and love. And that also appears to me to be characteristic of a lot of kids, regardless of their sexuality. It's about love and romance and connection and emotional intimacy. So even while we are, the media are sort of saying it's all about sex, the kids are saying, well, yeah, the sex is there, but let's talk about love.
Well, and along those lines, and, you know, more to what a lot of the stuff that we deal with on this show more often, is the churches having to deal with this new attitudes of youth that, unlike what we've really seen before, and churches trying to deal with sexuality, which in my opinion is that I think churches should deal with sexuality in youth, and I think it's an important, because it's an important part of development, and churches, especially in youth groups, can have, you know, an incredible impact in that area.
Absolutely.
How do churches approach this? Because, I mean, you're wanting to maintain this idea of sort of, you know, you want, and I hate to say sexual purity because that sounds very, you know, like
prudish.
We've discovered
that Cole is a prude in the last couple hours.
But you know, sort of, sexual respect, I guess, would be a better way to say that.
Yeah.
But also sexual honesty. You know, you want to be honest with these kids in development, and a lot of. I mean, I had a youth minister who came to me who was asking me because I'm a gay Christian. He has a gay kid in his youth group who's active, but when it comes to sexuality, you know, it's just sort of off in the corner because they don't know how to address that with him, and so he doesn't really have any sort of feeling of obligation or responsibility as far as, you know, what would be the somewhat Christian idea of sexuality. I mean, how do we match these two sort of opposite ends together?
I think it's going to be very difficult for adults to do that, because no matter what they say, it is still very much ingrained that homosexual sex is different than heterosexual sex. Whereas in reality, it's not. Exactly the same principles should be involved about respect, honesty, communication, safety. All of those issues are very critical, just as they are for straight kids. But once again, I think it's that adults are really, really uncomfortable with the topic. But the principles are exactly the same. Now, I think it will be very difficult for many churches to handle this. And it's not perhaps because of the ministerial people. They might, in fact, be educated. They might understand this. But I think a lot of people, the membership, the adult memberships, and the people who are 60 and 70, who may, in fact, be really the financial background of a church, might begin to feel very uncomfortable with this topic. And so I think it's potentially is a topic that can really split a church. And I think youth ministers have to be very, very careful about this issue and always sort of gauge where this fits into the life of the church. And in the same way, and I think this is the obligation of the ministerial staff, is to educate the church members about this topic, either through, you know, the Sunday morning services or through educational program, because I think this is a really difficult topic for 40 and 50 and 60-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that it's going to have to be, you know, sort of approached with them in a way that normalizes as much as possible and the multiple sexual expressions. And remember that most gay kids have heterosexual sex as well. And so it's not that the gay kids are only having sex with other gay kids. And indeed, most of gay kids will tell you that their first sexual partner was a heterosexual person. So you see, there's also a lot of interesting issues involved, where if one goes around somehow condemning same-sex behavior, we're also delivering a message to a fair number of straight kids who have had gay sex but who are not gay themselves. And they may have been motivated by various different reasons for having gay sex. So once again, it's a very complex sort of topic, and I think once again churches can talk about love and acceptance about their same-sex attracted individuals. They may have a different approach towards sexual behavior per se, but I think the principles ought to be the same.
So if someone were to, you know, and which I think should be done, write a curriculum, an honest sort of curriculum with churches with sexuality, it'd be just as important to write it for the adults of a church as it would be for the teenagers of a church.
Yes, but I think it's probably going to be a separate sort of curriculum.
Right.
But I don't know whether or not very many churches have adult programs on sexuality, on teenage sexuality, or sexuality, period.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a real missing link, which is too bad in a way, because I think that a lot of kids who are coming to terms with their sexuality would like it if their parents were able and willing to talk about these issues. And most kids feel like their parents would be the last person that they would want to talk about their sexuality, which is really, really unfortunate, because in many ways the parents are a tremendous source of support and perspective. But hey, if the parents aren't educated, they're going to be saying the wrong things, which is what kids know, of course.
Right. Well, it seems to me that we also are seeing a lot more kids seem to be a lot more able to reconcile their sexuality with their religion. I mean, I went through a tough time dealing with Christianity and being gay, and had some really just dark moments about it before I finally came around to the point that I am now. But it seems when you look at like these MySpace profiles and you look at kids who are gay, I mean, you see more of this sort of, like they say, you know, religion, Christian, sexual orientation, gay, which to me was surprising to find. So are you finding that happening a lot more?
I think so. I mean, it is important to recognize that for a significant number of gay kids, their religion is actually a source of support. Now, maybe not the organized part of it, but a lot of kids can separate the institution of religion from their own personal spirituality. And I think for a lot of kids, in fact, there is some research that shows that that one source of support and one source of strength and resiliency for some kids is their religion. So insofar as we can keep kids linked with their religion, then I think that can be a very healthy development, as long as that religion allows for same-sex sexuality or encourages sort of self-respect and self-expression. And it's really it's really unfortunate in many ways that institutional religion has been sort of placed up against same-sex sexuality. It's a really unfortunate division. And I think a lot of progressive Christianity recognizes this and is coming to sort of say, no, we need to show that religion is not against homosexuality, that religion has a place to incorporate a variation and, you know, in expression and diversity of sexual expression.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, and you know, that's part of what we try to do here on this show. So you have a history in the church. You said you got your master's degree from Chicago Divinity School. I guess you grew up Disciples of Christ. Are you surprised that the issue of sexuality has come to the forefront? I mean, of just being the church issue so quickly, and that it's so divided?
Yes, I think in many ways, because for me growing up, as I assume it is for a lot of people, the religion, the church, was totally separate from sexuality. I can't ever remember having any kind of discussion at all about sexuality in any of my youth groups. And it also appeared to me that as I became a youth minister myself, that this was one topic that we couldn't talk about, which is kind of bizarre because kids are very sexualized and they're becoming, trying to get, come to terms with their sexuality. And yet this is the one topic we couldn't talk about. And I sort of implicitly knew that, even though I felt like that there were some kids in my youth group who were really struggling with their same-sex sexuality. And actually there was one of my kids who actually attempted suicide, and I really felt like the issue was about him being gay but not being able to recognize it. And yet I could not talk about it. I felt like I absolutely could not approach that issue. But as I sort of began to see a wider world beyond where I grew up in Missouri about religion, and as my own sister, my biological sister, began to be a part of the born-again, right-wing, evangelical, fundamentalist, speaking in tongues branch of Christianity, and as I began to be a Unitarian and actually wrote some curriculum for high school kids on gender and sexuality, it seemed to me that religion was this incredibly broad perspective. And so there could be a place for kids somewhere in religion. And what I do today is to encourage kids not to give up their religious quality about their lives, but to try to find a religious home that will accept them and they feel comfortable with. Now, living in upstate Ithaca, New York, there are, in fact, many churches who do that. Even churches that have titles of Methodist and Baptist will, and even Catholic, have components where kids can feel comfortable with their sexuality and attend those services. But I also realize that I live in a very strange community.
Well, you know, and an interesting thing for me is to look at the church in Europe versus the church in America. I mean, they're two incredibly different monsters there, though we all have theoretically the same foundation. Why do you think the church in Europe has been, and even though it does have its issues, has been so, I guess, much more progressive in accepting, you know, the different styles of sexuality, whereas it seems like the church in America and as a result, the entire country is stuck?
I don't know for sure, but I wonder if it's the extent to which the church, a lot of times, various churches in Europe have not had sort of the stranglehold on their culture in a way that has been true in the United States. And so I think in a way that churches in Europe have had to adjust in a way that American churches feel like they don't have to, that they can take a strong stand and say, this is what America is all about. This is what our country is all about. And I think with a much larger sense of history and perspective, that a lot of European churches realize that if they're going to survive and be consistent with the more liberal culture of their time, that they cannot take a stand on something seemingly so insignificant. When you think about sort of biblical, the biblical literature, to sort of take this one issue out is so bizarre. I think sometimes, you know, that if religious people want to be against homosexuality, I'm sort of saying, I think to myself, why are you selecting this one item? Why not take shoplifting and be against shoplifters? Because there are a lot of episodes, you know, there are a lot of things in the Bible about not stealing and not taking, you know, what's not yours. So why isn't the religious right against shoplifting? Why aren't they monitoring stores and trying to stop all of this kind of stealing? There certainly would be a lot more biblical background for that kind of attitude or approach. And so I think there's some really unwritten history here or perspective about why homosexuality has reached such a pitch here in the United States that is just not characteristic in other cultures.
I think to also just to kind of play the role of maybe people who are on the other side and would disagree with us, I think one thing that they've said quite a bit is they feel like they've been driven and I'm not saying this is how it is, but they feel like they've been driven to confront homosexuality by organizations and groups within the church and just outside the church and the culture who have, who are advocating for, gay rights, a better place for gay people in the church and so forth. And so I think that's what they perceive as the difference. And I don't think that's necessarily the case, but just in fairness to their perspective, I guess.
Right. But it's still, I'm still not quite sure. There have been many groups that have confronted the church about a lot of different kinds of issues. And yet this one issue seems to have stuck in a way that a lot of other issues have not. Maybe the comparable thing would be abortion, perhaps, mm-hmm. where that has stuck. And I keep thinking, like, why homosexuality? Why is this such an evil? Now, I certainly recognize the history. There's a long history of homosexuality being problematic from a legal, ethical, moral, pathological sense. And yet, it's amazing that this has been such a major focus. Now, in my more cynical mode, which is not hard to get into, I think, well, it's a moneymaker. It's a way in which membership has grown. It's a way in which financial aid to the religious right has grown immensely. It's become sort of that touchstone. That is, our culture is going down the tubes. It's so secular, and this is the one issue that we have to fight. And if we defeat this issue, it almost feels like the religious right is saying we will become again a moral, upright Christian society. But we have it all hinges on this one issue of homosexuality. I'm not quite sure why all and so much has been placed on this one issue, but it is an important one for so many, many churches.
And I want to go back real quick to the ex-gay issue.
Yes.
And because I've done interviews on the show with people in leaders of the ex-gay movement. Actually, Chad Thompson, who was in that article from Time Magazine,
yes.
Was on the show, and some other people. And there's different levels that they claim. I mean, Chad's story, from what he told me, was that he had same-sex attraction starting at 10 or whatever, but never actually engaged in any sort of same-sex relations. As a matter of fact, hasn't engaged in any sort of sexual relations as of yet, from what he told me. And then you have some people who say, you know, they were way into the gay lifestyle, and now they're married, have children, and don't have any sexual attractions towards guys whatsoever. How do you explain ex-gays?
Well, first off, I don't believe that they no longer have them. I believe they're there. They may not recognize them, they may not think about them, but I've looked at the research, and as far as I can see, there's no evidence at all that those same-sex attractions go away. Now, yes, you can focus less on them. Yes, you can make yourself fantasize heterosexual sex fantasies, and yes, you can perform heterosexually. But I'm just not convinced that those same-sex feelings or attractions or impulses go away. And indeed, I think a lot of the leaders of the ex-gay movement recognize that. That is, that if you really, in sort of in-depth interviews with them, they recognize, well, no, I do still have them, and they do come up, but I fight them. I pray that Christ will lead me away from those. So I mean, that's a part that I do believe that it is possible to sort of put them in a little box and just in your mind and just try to put them back. But I don't think they go away. So I think that is a choice. Now, would I consider that to be a healthy choice? I'm not so sure I would, but once again, I'm not judging their lives. It may be that for them, the whole sense of the wrongness of homosexuality is so strong that they feel like they cannot lead a good or moral life having those attractions or acting on them. So that's a choice that they make, and that's their choice, But it's when they begin to go that extra step, which is to try to convert other people who don't feel that way. And it is absolutely true, and the ex-gay movement cannot deny this, that in their history are some incredibly unethical, immoral experiments and techniques that have been used against people. And these are well documented, you know, electrodes, relearning techniques that have absolutely destroyed lives and families. So this is part of their history, and they may be kinder and gentler now, and Chad, I think, is one of those, but they, I think, have to absolutely recognize their history and say this is where we have come from, and whether they want to be a part of that, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's and on that same sort of that same issue, and actually it's even broader than that, and one of the problems that we deal with is this whole sense of sort of anti-intellectualism and anti-science. And it's like, it doesn't matter what the research says. It doesn't matter what the facts are. I feel differently. How do we as intellectuals, as people who respect data and science and don't think that that destroys our, you know, doesn't negate our faith, how do we approach people who have almost no rational basis of discussion?
It is extraordinarily difficult, and I struggle with that issue, for example, with my sister, constantly when we have contact, because she is one of those people who just absolutely will not hear the research. She could care less about what the research shows, because her minister tells her something, and that is the truth. And so I think what I do myself is I approach it on the personal level, and I think that's the only way in which they understand. Or to say there are alternative religious perspectives. There are other ministers who believe in a different way. Or I make arguments against, well, you know, here's a biblical verse against judging or, you know, making these kinds of evaluations. It's not very effective, I understand. But I do think that sometimes that personal approach can work a little bit better. But once again, it's very, very difficult. I have relatives who intellectually and theologically would be against everything that I'm for. But they accept me as their nephew, their grandson, their brother, as a person. And they don't reject me. They welcome me into their home because there is enough in their religion about loving and caring. Yes, they may pray for me every night. And I do believe that those bridges probably won't be made. And, you know, I hate to give up on some people, but I think at some point you do have to. And you have to find different communities of support and understanding who do have your values of science, of caring and loving and support, and a broader sense of that word rather than a very narrow sense. I wish I could be more optimistic, but my own experience has been there are some minds which are so totally closed on this issue, and as long as their minister is espousing hate and condemnation, you know, there's not much I can do to argue against that, quite frankly.
Well, and with the younger generation, which we can be a lot more optimistic about, I think, is there any fear on your part that as these people mature to adulthood, that their more open and accepting perspectives might become closed?
Yes, I do worry about that, and I it's a difficult road. And I mean, because there is some research that actually shows that as kids get older, they do become a little bit more conservative and a little bit more in agreement with their parental sort of values. So I do worry about that. That once out in the real world of exposure to various influences, that they may come back around to a more conservative stance. The optimism in me says, well, if at one point they were liberal, and if they in fact know other people who are friends and family members, that will in some ways sort of protect them against a more hateful approach. So, you know, I hate to say that I think that America will become more liberal as the older generation dies, because that's not quite giving tribute to older people who, in fact, are able and willing to change. But I'll tell you, it's very difficult when I talk with 60, 70, 80-year-old people about this issue. They just, it's so gut, it's so real, it's so much a part of what they grew up with. So I am optimistic that some of the younger people have not grown up under that kind of, you know, pathology and that kind of hatefulness. I've actually talked with parents who who are themselves very uncomfortable with homosexuality, but they also recognize that the future of their children's world will be very different than theirs, and they recognize that they don't want to be teaching their children hatred against any group. Even though they themselves may hate different groups, they don't believe that that's the world for their children. And they sort of feel like, well, you know, it's probably true that in a world of the future there's going to be a diversity of groups, and it's not good to go around hating these groups.
Would you say it's more being just uncomfortable with them and not necessarily hatred?
It's a combination. I think uncomfortableness is the much stronger word for it, I do believe. That is that many in the older generation feel very uncomfortable, but yet they are for gay rights. I mean, they don't believe that gay people ought to be killed, or they don't believe that gay kids ought to be victimized or bullied. So I think that is progress, you see, in a very significant way, even for that older generation. So I think that there are ways to move different generations. And in some, it may be moving them to a point of at least tolerance for equal rights, for safety. And for them, that may be all that you can sort of expect, because they really are uncomfortable with the topic. But I think with younger kids, I think they've already accepted the issue of equal rights. I don't think that sort of is an issue for hardly any of the kids, even the most homophobic. They say, oh, yeah, they ought to have their rights. And you'll see that in poll data, really good poll data, of high school kids, that roughly 80 to 90% feel very comfortable, I mean, not comfortable, sorry. they're in favor of gay rights. And they think that Boy Scout leaders, it's okay for them to be gay. It's okay for teachers to be gay. They're even okay with gay couples adopting children. So they do believe in those gay rights, even if they don't feel so totally comfortable themselves.
Well, we've talked a lot about differences in age in terms of how people feel about homosexuality. I wanted to ask about, and I have nothing really to go on here, but ask about differences in gender. Are girls and women, and this is just anecdotally what I would see or think, more a little more open, a little more accepting than, say, men and boys are? Do they have that same history of dealing with kind of this patriarchal perspective, that there's more sympathy and understanding there than there would be with guys?
There actually is research that supports that view, because I think there is some evidence for that. That is that women and girls are a little bit more open and accepting. And I think they don't take it quite as a personal affront as a lot of guys do. They don't feel that whole, like, oh, my gosh, this threatens my femininity, as guys feel like it threatens their masculinity. Now, I think in part there's an interesting thing going on, too, which is that in really pretty good poll data of college students, this is college students now, which would indicate that upwards of 20% of young women in colleges, not just Liberal, Oberlin, and Cornell, those kinds of places, 20% of young women will say they have same-sex attractions, or they might find same-sex appealing, or they could see themselves falling in love with another girl. Now, that's 20%. Now, that's an incredible percent. You cannot get that number of guys willing to say that they have the same kind of thing. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't that many. I don't know. But you'll find half as many guys sort of saying same-sex attractions would be okay, or I would like to have sex with a guy even though I'm straight. So it may be that simply for women, sexuality is not so either-or sort of thing, and that many can recognize there is a middle ground that they can stand on, because themselves they say, yeah, you know, I can imagine kissing another girl. That sounds kind of good. Sounds kind of erotic to me.
But they wouldn't necessarily define themselves as bisexual.
No, right? No, not at all. In fact, they might. It's interesting. A lot of these women, they don't quite like the word heterosexual or straight, and they don't like lesbian or bisexual or queer. So they might label themselves as unlabeled, that is, don't label me, or they might say, I'm not heterosexual, or they might say, I'm not straight, but they're not willing to put another label to themselves. Or they might say, yes, I'm straight, but, hey, yeah, if the right woman came around, you know, whatever. So once again, I think there is a basic gender difference there. Though once again, it would be interesting if guys could do the same thing. And there is some evidence that would indicate that with the younger generation of guys, that they are more willing to recognize that maybe within themselves they have some same-sex attractions, even though they consider themselves to be heterosexual.
Well, the book is The New Gay Teenager from Harvard University Press, and the author is Rich Savin Williams. Thank you very much for being with us this morning.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
And, you know, keep us up to date on if you have any other interesting work coming out.
I will do that.
Okay. You have a good morning.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'd like to thank Rich for being on the phone with us. And that was a very interesting discussion. I was glad that we had it. What did you guys think?
I enjoyed the interview. I thought he was very... I mean, he really done his homework and,
right.
I mean, was ready with... just had a lot of the research that he had done, you know, on the top of his...
Yeah. Well, and I would recommend, I mean, anybody out there who works with youth, and whether or not you're liberal or conservative or work with gay youth or straight youth, or if you work with youth, you work with both. But go out and pick up a copy of The New Gay Teenager, because it really has some incredible insights into the youth culture as a whole. Because, I mean, how they view sexuality, I think, will affect how they view lots of other things. So... I mean, I've read through most of it, and I would recommend checking that out. It's from Harvard University Press, called The New Gay Teenager. You can link to it, to information on it from the website, ChristianDissent.com. But, I mean, again, I think it's important for anybody working with youth or youth-related products just to get a nice perspective of the information. Yes, Joey, you're chomping at the bit.
I said, and conservatives can read the book and find strategies to combat the youth.
Right, right. You guys can figure out how to combat this liberal streak of youth. See, that's why I think the culture war is over. I think the liberals have won, and because I think once this new generation, the kids come up, things are going to get a lot better.
I think the culture war is a myth anyway.
Well, true. Quite possibly. Much like the war on the Chronicles of Narnia.
The war on Christmas.
And the war on Christmas. That is definitely a myth. Oh, my gosh.
Well, I don't necessarily know about that. I mean, this woman yesterday, I work at a customer care center, and she called in and complained about they're playing Christmas music at a store, one of our stores.
Well, that's probably a backlash of this whole...
That's true.
You know, she's probably just trying to get back at...
Right.
Anyway, so we're coming up to the end of the show. You have been listening to Christian Dissent Live.
Song's only 2.5 minutes.
I know. I've got to try to work all this timing out. See, this is radio,
so
guys.
That's why you cut me off when I went on my tangent about Christmas.
Well, because I just think you're wrong.
I think it's both sides, though. I think there's an extreme on both sides.
Well, yeah. I mean, there always is. I will be the first to acknowledge that there are some liberal extremes out there that take things just a little bit too far. And
that's the point I was making.
Yeah, they take them to the point of making it a full circle back. You know, you get so liberal, next thing you know, you're a conservative.
Next thing you know, you're picking on Jewish people.
You're picking on Jewish people and accusing them of being persecuted. How dare you? Are you approved,
right.
Like I've become. But, you know, it's the war on Christmas again. I mean, I think it definitely is a myth. I don't think there's any, I don't think there's a group of people who sit around the table, November planning Christmas decorations going, we must remove Christ from the Christmas. You know, happy holidays, that'll do it. You know.
It can be very strange sometimes.
Yeah, well, you know, that's why they put me on the radio. It's just insane, you know, it's a conspiracy. I mean, Happy Holidays has been around for a long time. I mean, right. Happy Holidays, you know, it's hardly anything.
But, I mean, I will say that there's that car commercial where they sing, we wish you a happy holidays.
No, it's wish you a happy Honda days.
Yeah.
Oh, it is.
It's a
okay.
Honda commercial.
That makes sense.
See, I said the same
so
thing.
So they're selling.
Yeah, you see, that okay. right there is the disgusting thing about Christmas
exactly.
is that I think Honda Days is far more offensive than Honda Days.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
We wish you a happy Honda Days. And oh, Honda does not underwrite this show, by the way. Because they did, we couldn't make fun of them. Because right? we'd have to be, right. you know, we'd have to compromise for sponsorship.
No compromise.
No compromise. Here we go. Okay, we're about time where we can start the song in a couple of seconds here. Anyway, this has been Christian Descent Live. Check us out online at ChristianDescent.com. Email me at Cole@ChristianDescent.com. Tell me what you want to hear.
Let us know when you're offended and I'll apologize for us.
Next week, Joey and Josh will be in the studio by themselves. I'll be out of town. I think I might call in. I don't know. We'll see what happens. Anyway, I won't see you until after Christmas, so Merry Christmas. Happy Kahanaka.
Happy Kwanzaa and Festivus.
And Kwanzaa and Festivus and all that jazz. And here we go, a little bit Muppets.
Boxing Day for you Canadians.
And Boxing Day. And this is a song that Josh Tinley once played at his funeral.
It's off the Muppets Christmas album.
Thank you.